Welcome back, everybody, to another episode of Orale Ball Heights, coming at you from Espacio 1839 here in Ball Heights. Another awesome day. And today I am joined by Carlos Aguilar, who's a film critic and writer. Welcome, Carlos.
Thank you for having me, Eric.
Thank you so much again for wanting to do this interview, because I know I just hit you up on Twitter over a week ago, and right. You're like, hell yeah, man, I'm down. Like, come through.
Yeah, sounds good. I mean, I love the space. I feel like I should have known about Espacio a long time ago.
Yeah, dude. I mean, it's easy to overlook it if you are not in the neighborhood, right? So it's easy because, you know, I think for me, being part of the community and being so used to it, I'm like, yeah, it's just that regular store we have, right? So kind of taking it for granted at times, because I know not everybody in their community has a space like that. So for sure, always grateful to Nico and his wife Myra for like the space they created and for opening this studio up for folks like me to come through. But super excited to have you on today, because I'm a big fan of your writing, of your critiquing, and really just wanting to talk to you about that. You as a writer and a film critic, what that is, your experiences over the years, right, growing into that role, you know, from your early starts to now writing for places like the LA Times, New York Times, Variety, Remezcla, a lot of other places in between, the Rap, IndieWire. Right. It's just like the list goes on. Do you ever just like stop to yourself and be like, damn, that's me?
I mean, yeah, there's definitely moments in which, you know, you kind of, especially coming from where I come from, that those places feel so unattainable that when it happens, it's still very sort of shocking to see your byline in those places. So, yeah, I mean, there are moments like that. And also just like how tired I am all the time.
Yeah, you are constantly putting out new works, which I know like it doesn't, the timeline of like how things get published doesn't automatically translate to you finish writing something and then it gets published, right? But yeah, you're always like every week you tweet something, guys, like this week I'm like talking about this movie, or this week I'm going to be at this panel discussion with this director and talking about their movie. This kind of, I mean, just from watching from the outside in, it seems kind of surreal to see you doing that like on a regular basis.
It is, even for me. Yeah, I agree.
So I mean, let's get into it right away with you sharing with folks a little bit about yourself and where you grew up.
Yeah, I grew up in Mexico City. For anyone that knows Mexico City, I grew up in the north sort of part of it, Gustavo Madero, which is where the Basilica de Guadalupe is, you know, working class neighborhoods.
All right.
Basically the tip of the map of the city, if you ever look at the city of Mexico, the map of Mexico City. My mom and my dad were born from Mexico City. My grandparents were from Michoacán. And so Mexico City was mostly all I knew when I was a kid. And yeah, we live in a very small apartment. I have a younger brother who was born when I was 6. And I was very much into movies since I was a kid.
Really?
I think it was also part of the fact that we were poor.
Okay.
And we never had money for a video game console. So we never had video games. And
I feel that.
And we never had money to take a vacation. Like, we never went. I think we went to Acapulco once in the years that I lived in Mexico City. And so my mom, what she would be able to afford in terms of, like, taking me and my brother out would be to the movies, you know? Because in Mexico City back then in the 90s and very, very early 2000s, there was, like, on Wednesdays, it was, like, 2-for-1 at the movie
theater. Yeah, budget screenings.
Right, or, like, matinee screenings or whatnot. So we would go those, and, like, the movies were, like, usually the most accessible thing, and, you know, we will watch movies at home. My dad will go to the tianguis and buy, you know, like, bootleg VHS first and then DVD. And, you know, so that's, and then in Mexican television, I don't know if you remember, like, you know, Canal 5 would show, like, all the American blockbusters dubbed in Spanish. So like
the best.
Yeah, so I would watch a lot of those. So, yeah, movies. My mom is a very, it's interesting because my mom has, like, a great school education. I think she only, you know, finished elementary school and then had to start working. But she was always very curious about film and literature, so she reads a lot. She always read a lot. We always had books at home. You know, books that she'll buy, like, secondhand books or, you know, like, you know, that she would just get at the tianguis or whatever. And yeah. she was always reading, and she liked movies a lot. And it definitely, it's that, you know, I feel like that's really the privilege that me and my brother had, that my mom was someone that, you know, liked culture, and like she would, you know, find the days that the museum was free, and she would take us to the museum, we'll take the bus.
That's awesome.
You know, so I feel like that's definitely my influence in terms of like, you know, because people don't expect it when you come from those communities, don't expect you to even be interested in those things or be aware, you know.
Yeah, they're out here expecting you to eat like tortas de tamale and stuff.
Yeah, which, you know, they're not bad, but you know, so yeah, so I think that's my dad was, you know, that's a whole other dark story.
Yeah.
He was, you know, very much not very present in terms of like me and my brother sort of growing up, and you know, but my mom really did like double duty almost in terms of, you know, sort of taking care of us and like making sure that we will go to, you know, that we had access to like see something else. You know, I think there was also like a bookstore that sold like cheap books, that it was like a government subsidized bookstore, and then we'll get like little books there.
All right.
Yeah. And I had a teacher in elementary school that she saw that I really liked to write and read, and she would lend me books that she had at home and whatnot. So yeah, I do feel like there was, you know, when I think about like, why am I even, you know, why do I like writing? What do I like movies? I always think like there's always a seed somewhere, right? So it had to be my mom or this teacher and people that when I was very young sort of like saw that there was something there that I, you know, that I like, or that I don't want to say I was good at, but you know, because how good can you be at 7, 6 years old, but that I like. So yeah.
Did you have any favorite movies growing up?
I mean, I think it was, you know, mostly Disney films at first.
Yeah.
It was
being that age. Yeah.
Yeah. It was mostly that. I think the, and then I always tell the story, but like, you know, the sort of big breakthrough for me was, when I was like 11, right, a couple years before I came to the U.S., there was a film critic on TV that was talking about this French film called Amelie.
Mm.
And he just talked about it so, you know, compellingly. And I just was fascinated by this, and I had to see it. And it was, you know, like in most cities, you know, the art house cinemas, the movie theaters that play the foreign films or the international independent.
Was this when the movie like was first like making this like? This
yeah, when it when it first sort of came out in theaters, and it was only playing like in Reforma, like in the sort of like more affluent neighborhoods in Mexico City. So me and my mom, I convinced her to like, you know, trek the city so we could go see this movie, and we went, and it was just like a mind blowing experience. And I feel like I hold it to, you know, in a very endearing place because of the time that I saw it. It really was the first time that I engaged with movies beyond, you know, beyond what was on TV, beyond animation, Disney animation. It was really sort of like a real important moment for me. And like, whatever, you know, a lot of people, I think it's turning 20 years this year, which is crazy. A lot of people, it has fallen out of favor with certain people because it's really sentimental. It's sort of like, you know,
we look at things like that with movie quartz glasses. Yeah,
right. But for me, it's just, you know, it's even beyond. For that movie specifically, it goes beyond like the quality of it, or like the artistic merits, you know, which I think there are some, you know. It's really just an important movie for me as a person. So I feel like that's probably the one that really, you know, made me want to be a filmmaker, because I never wanted to be a film critic growing up. I wanted to be a filmmaker, you know.
And all right. Yeah. So were you thinking, like, I'm going to be a director, I'm going to be, like, behind the scenes, like, a camera person? Like,
no, I wanted to be a director.
From the get-go.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's one of those things, like, I knew that's what I wanted to be. And I also feel like one of the, I think that the best gift my mom ever gave me was that whenever I would say I want to be a director or I want to work in the movies, she never said, that's impossible. She never put it down. She said, well, let's see how it can happen. You know, let's see how it can be a reality. And I think that just the fact that she never, you know, she never made it seem like an impossibility made me feel like it wasn't an impossibility. And I feel like that's such a big gift, you know, because it's, you know, when you're from those places, like, of course she didn't know if it was going to happen or not. Like, she had no idea whether, you know, my mom's a woman who never had any money, or, you know, just comes from a different place that doesn't even know how the film industry works or how these films work, you know. But she, you know, just didn't want to sort of crush that. And I think that was very powerful for me.
That makes a big difference, having that support.
Right.
Yeah.
So, yeah, and so I wanted to be a filmmaker, and that clearly didn't pan out, but...
Did you, as when you were younger and maybe like a teenager and old, a little bit older, Did you have any opportunities to direct or like produce movies?
So, of course, we never had a camera, but me and my brother, we would put like little plays with like plush, with like little peluches or whatnot, and like we will do it like every week. We will like reenact movies because we didn't have a camera, so we were just like literally acting out things. And I remember like when I was like maybe like in fifth or sixth grade, the elementary school that I was at asked people for like to write a play, and so I wrote this crazy play about like an island where like there were rats and some crazy stuff, and like, you know, they put it on and it was like me directing this little play.
Wow.
Yeah, but it was like, that was, you know, that back then that was like the only thing, because then I didn't have access to a camera. There were no cell phones, you know, like I didn't know anyone that even had like a VHS camera, like no one in my family did.
Dark times in technology.
Right. You know, I'm sure that there were, you know, wealthier people in Mexico that at the time had like camcorders and things like mm-hmm. that, but we didn't, you know. So yeah, so I never got the chance until high school in the US. That's when sort of it took more of shape, actually making something.
What did you remember what you made when you were here?
Yeah, of course. So I went to, when I came to the U.S., I came by myself without my mom or brother. And I came to live with an aunt who became sort of like my second mom here. Mm-hmm. And she lives still in Carahey in Southeast L.A. So I went to Bell High School because that's the only high school for those.
Hey, what's up?
So I went to Bell High, and the years that I was there, I don't know if they're still doing it, probably not, but the years that I was there, there was a Call Arts had like a little partnership with Bell that they will have an after school film program that people from Call Arts will come and teach
like
the students.
Students enrolled over there, like mentor over here.
Yeah, it will mentor in Bell High after school. So I would stay after school to take this film course for with the Call Arts folks. And I remember I made like a few music videos and a couple shorts, and then they will put them into festivals. So then when I graduated high school, I applied to Call Arts, you know, stupidly, but I got in. I got into the film production program, right? Like they accepted, they accepted me and all that. But of course, you know, being undocumented, and it was before DACA, before anything. Like, I mean, an art school like that is so expensive for anyone.
It's private school, right?
Yeah, anyone. Just like for any average, you know, U.S. born person, whatever, is expensive. Just imagine, like it was sort of like unfeasible, you know. I mean, it was kind of those bittersweet things of like, you know, I'm good enough that they said yes to me in the application, mm-hmm. but I also know that I cannot attend.
Yeah, and looking at the reality of things, yeah. So, I mean, I want to circle back a little bit. For you, what was that transition like between having to leave Mexico and your family as a teenager and then coming over here? How was that transition for you?
It was very difficult. You know, it was one of those things of like, in accepting sort of the fact that, you know, my dad had problems with alcohol, mm-hmm. and, you know, he worked a government job that paid very little. And my mom didn't work. She was, you know, just taking care of me and my brother. She would sell like Avon or say, you know, just sell things here and there.
Okay. Hustling.
So we didn't have money. And like at some point was like, you know, we're not going to be able to give you an education past like, you know, a middle school, a secundaria. So they're like, your aunt is offering to like take you in, you know, and it was sort of like a choice of like, you know, is it basically no school or do nothing and get to work and like or take a chance on this? And it was very hard, you know, because you're like at an age that you're like a teenager.
Yeah,
you're very volatile as a person as it is, and then sort of like coming into a place where like, you know, my aunt was great and my cousins were great, but my aunt's husband wasn't very happy with me being there, and it was sort of like there was conflict, and so that was hard, you know. Of course, I didn't speak any English, and I went to the first year that I was here because Bell High School is always overpopulated.
Yeah, most schools are right. Back then too.
So the first year, my ninth grade, I went to Crenshaw High.
Oh, wow.
I will take the bus at Bell High School, and they will drive us to Crenshaw High School.
That is quite a difference.
So I, you know, it was, you know, it was an experience, you know. I went to ESL classes. It was a group of like kids from all over Latin America, most of them Mexican, Central America, you know, Salvadorans Guatemalans, and, you know, started learning English there. And then once I, you know, in 10th grade, I came back to Bell High, and it was interesting because I think in Crenshaw, because I was mostly hanging out with the same ESL kids.
Yeah, it's a little tight-knit group.
Yeah, I felt like it was... I didn't feel sort of like... I felt like I had a group of people that were like in the same boat, right? But then when I came to Bell High, which is like, you know, 90-something percent Latino, but they were all, most of them were like born here, raised here. So to them, I was the Mexican kid. Like I was the kid that just came from Mexico.
A paisa kid.
Right, that didn't speak English, that, you know, had an accent. And that sort of was like for like really from Mexico. Like they were like, you know, I feel like people have gotten better at this, but I remember back then people would be like, oh, I'm not Mexican, my parents are. Like it was like very defined that people wanted to be like, you know, like, oh, I'm not, my parents are Mexican, but I'm
That's
not
interesting too. I mean, it makes sense because you're in high school, you're at a young age, and those identity politics haven't fully settled in, but they're already starting to take shape. And like you said, explains a lot that I'm not Mexican, but my parents are.
Yeah, and I feel like back then it was, I feel like now people are more, you know, want to embrace, you know, that part of them. But like back then, I feel like it was still, in 2004, I think, it was sort of like a different time, you know. And I remember one of the main things, it was like one of them got very offended because, you know, they were like, oh, you're Mexican, you must like Chalino. And I swear to you, I had no idea who Chalino was. Because in Mexico City, that's, you know, it's like in Mexico City, the music is like cumbias or rock en español or, you know, like my parents didn't listen to, you know, norteño or banda, none of that, because that's, it's a different era. But they assumed that because I was from Mexico, I would know who Chalino is. And they were offended that I didn't know. And I was just like, I truly didn't, had no idea, you know?
Yeah, what do you want me to do, man? Yeah.
So it was an interesting experience being sort of like the Mexican kid from Mexico in a high school that was mostly Mexican-American kids, you know?
Man, was that experience frustrating? I mean, it sounds like it was frustrating.
A little bit, yeah. But I had to, I mean, I had to force myself to learn English as quick as I could so I could, you know, because by the time I went to Bell High, they had taken me out of ESL. Like I was already like in regular classes. Like I did all I did all the levels of ESL in 1 year in Crenshaw. So by the time I came to Bell, I was already in full English classes, which was intimidating, you know, because like, yes, like I think I could, you know, sort of like do well, but like all these kids would like make fun of my accent, or like I will answer sort of like a question and not pronounce something correctly, and they'll be like, you know. So it was, you know, and then I look back at it and it was like, you know, it's kids being sort of like insecure or sort of like finding the target of the person that's like the different one, you know? But eventually I made friends, you know, and it's interesting because a lot of my friends from high school, they were from that precise generation that all of their parents got papers through the amnesty in the 80s.
All right.
So like they were like, because all of their parents were already citizens, you know, and like I remember back then not understanding how all of them had this experience, but then I realized that there was sort of like a generation of kids who were the children of people, you know, who had already become citizens or at least residents back then.
So this is a big influence now that like most folks really like look back on it, because that changed so many people's lives for the better.
Right. And also it meant that for a lot of these kids, they had gone back to Mexico multiple times because their parents were able to go to Mexico. So a lot of my closest friends had a relationship with Mexico, meaning that they had gone back to where their parents were from, you know, so they were not super alienated from, you know, from that.
I happen to know a lot of folks like that too, and it makes a big difference because you're expanding your boundaries. You know, you get to leave your neighborhood, your community, your safe space. You know, you're introduced to something new, and for a lot of folks that I've talked to, it's a very grateful experience to be able to connect with your, you know, with your family history, your roots, especially as you get older and you start seeing and acknowledging that not everybody has that privilege, right, to be able to go and come back,
right.
So that high school is always a trip. I can only imagine in Belt. I mean, because it's so out there. What was it like living in Cudahy at the time, like between being in Mexico and then coming over here to Cela?
It was interesting because I had, you know, based on American movies, which are mostly about white suburban neighborhoods, I had a different idea of what houses and communities would look like, right?
Okay.
Because I assumed that everywhere in the U.S. would look the same, but it's clearly, you know, later I realized that the movies that I was watching were depicting, you know, neighborhoods where, like, you know, where kids have three houses and they're you know what I mean? Like, those, like, you know, like those, like, The Sandlot and those type of movies that depict, you know,
suburbia.
American.
Right. Yeah.
And when you don't know that that's not how everyone lives here, you know, it's like, it's a sort of like a trip, you know, to realize that, yeah, it's not the same. But I mean, it wasn't that hard in terms of like food and things like that, because, you know, my aunt, you know, she would cook Mexican food, and it's a very Mexican neighborhood, you know. But I will say that being from Mexico City, it's it's also peculiar, and you know, you probably understand the fact that, you know, there's not that many people from Mexico City in terms of, like, in comparison to, like, people from Michoacán or Sinaloa here. I feel like
the
minority, you know, and that's a lot of reasons, I'm sure. But so it was interesting to me that, like, Mexico City was sort of, like, not the communities, the Mexican communities that were here were from other parts of Mexico.
Yeah, not in Cela. It's only until I got older that I was able to, like, really see how all the different regions were split up with, like, different communities, right? And how all of that has shifted over the years, over the decades. I mean, Bell and parts of, like, Southeast LA in the 30s up to after World War II, they were actually, like, white suburbs, right? So, you know, it wasn't until white flight and, like, a bunch of other shit happened that people left. And even communities like Boyle Heights, that it was in the same situation. And over time, it just changed into what it is. So, yeah, it makes a big difference once you have, like, that context of, like, oh, all right, well, I guess this is, like, the community that's here now and prospering because, you know, others moved on or they just decided to bounce. I don't know. You had to ask them.
Yeah, and I think I remember another thing I remember from those days is that I would go to, me and a friend from high school, we would go to Pacific a lot, Pacific Boulevard.
Pacific and Florence.
Huntington Park, because there was, back then, there were, like, two movie theaters, I think.
Yeah, I used to go to those theaters también.
The Warner Theater, which was, like, super cheap, and it was very ugly.
And they had arcades.
Yeah, it was not a pretty movie theater, but it was cheap. Back then, I remember, like, it was, like, with $20, the man will give me, you could buy a movie ticket, and you could buy Tacos Mexico had, like, a special for, like, three tacos and a soda for $5.
Yeah.
And I feel like an old person now talking about, like, those good old days, but, like, with $20, you could do so much on Pacific Boulevard. You could play the arcades, go to a movie, get some tacos.
That Saturn, the arcade on Saturn, it was underground. Right. I miss that arcade. It smelled so bad.
The movie theater was not pretty. I will say like, me and my friends had a joke that, like, that the moment you walked in, they give you a bucket and a stick, and the more rats you kill, the more popcorn you got. Because you could hear the rats in that movie theater.
Sticky floor y todo. Yep. Oh my God, memories.
But it was cheap, you know? So, yeah, Pacific Boulevard was definitely the, you know, because I think the closest mall was, like, Stonewood in Downey. And that was, like, you know, for a kid like that, it's like you had to take the bus. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, it was like a trip. So Pacific Boulevard was just, like, the 111 down Florence, a couple stops, and then you'll be in Pacific. So
Do you remember any of the movies you saw at that theater?
I think it was, like, Bewitched, a horrible movie with Nicole Kidman that it's not great.
Oh, that was the remake of the TV show, right. Yeah.
2004, 2005, and then maybe, like, a Superman movie that came out around those.
Oh, the one with Brandon Routh, probably, yeah.
So, yeah, The Incredibles, I think, the first Incredibles in 2005, 2004. Yeah, it was interesting. It was an interesting experience.
Were you sneaking stuff in?
Of course. Like candy or M&M, something like that.
Oh, man. So You were in Bell, you went through ESL fairly fast, and then how was it the rest of the time after, like, being in the general population and just being thrown into the deep end with, like, everybody else who's an English, like, first language speaker?
It got better, you know, with over time, because, again, you make friends, but it was still always sort of that, you know, little alienation. Of course, there were. I wasn't the only one, clearly, that it was, you know, undocumented or, like, you know, was ESL. Mm. But of course, I let a lot of people understand. I'm sure you probably do that. You know, those moments in senior year when, like, people are doing, like, FAFSA or, like, applications for things, like, those were, like, so, like, nerve wracking to me, because I feel like back then the teachers were not really even sort of, like, aware, or they just didn't have the language to deal with those situations. So, like, it was, like, I was embarrassed, like, you know, like, I was, like, whenever that we had a class that it was called, like, it was life skills, I don't know, it was a class in 12th grade that, you know, there was a teacher that would help you do applications for college and for financial aid, you know, and I dreaded that class so much, just by the fact that, like, I had to give explanations, or I had to, like, you know,
just
get the teacher aside and be like, I don't really want to discuss this,
like, hey bro, like, that's not for me. And then, well, why isn't that, like, anybody can go to college? No, not everybody can go to college.
Yeah, so I remember those being sort of, like, moments that were just very, you know, interesting. And there was, in 11th grade, I think, there was a trip to, I'm just thinking back of, like, those, the fears, you know, that when I was in 11th grade, I don't even know how it happened, but the school got a free trip for everyone that got an A in chemistry or physics to go to SeaWorld. And I wanted to go, but I was panicking.
Oh, San Diego SeaWorld,
right.
Yeah.
Right. So, you know, I was like, shit, can I even go to San Diego? I'm like, do I want to risk it? And like, I remember there was me and...
That sucks. I have to think about that as a kid.
Right? Because I was like, can I, you know, and my aunt was like, well, I don't know, you know.
I mean, honestly, looking back on it, I would have said, hell yeah, bro, you're a kid. Nobody's going to check shit.
Right.
You're
right there. But you live with that fear, right?
Yeah.
So it's like, I remember there was me and another girl who was a friend who was undocumented, and like we went to talk to the teacher, and like we were like trying to make sure that we weren't gonna stop anywhere, that the bus was gonna go, like, you know, because we were so concerned. Like, and we went and we had a good time, but like just having that in the back of your mind when you're coming back is like, when you think about it now, it's like that's, you know, so detrimental to your mental health in terms of like, can I even do this? Can I even enjoy
it? It sucks. Yeah, you have that hesitation of like, I don't know if I should be doing that. You know, I didn't go to San Diego for the first time to like a couple of years ago, and that was only because of work. And it was a trip to take a tour and learn about the community. But I was like, and I already had DACA at that point, so I was like, hell yeah, let's go to San Diego for the day and take a bus trip. So I want to go back for sure. Community that I want to learn more about and just like hang out like a regular person, just, you know, go get something to eat, go see stuff, and come back and enjoy my time.
Yeah, I went back. I think after that, I went back to cover Comic-Con, actually.
Hey.
So that was a different sort of experience now, more enjoyable. But yeah, I remember that trip in high school. It was just, you know, things like that, you know, for most people are like, they don't even understand what that is, you know, those sort of like fears, you know. I had friends too in high school that would like, you know, go to someone's house and drink, or like, you know, go throw eggs at things in Halloween, you know, and that I was just like, and I was just like, I can't do that, you know, like I'm gonna get in trouble and I'm gonna get deported, you know,
policing, yeah.
Yeah, it was just like, I cannot, you know, and I'm not saying those things are like good things to do, but you know, it's like they're just being stupid kids, and I feel like when you have this thing looming over your head, you are not, it's just a different dynamic in terms of how you relate to others and the things that, you know, how you experience life in general, you know, just thinking in the back of your mind. You know, I remember, you know, being in the car with my cousins, because I had a cousin who lived with me who was also undocumented, and driving with him, and like, you know, one time he forgot, you know, he didn't forget it. We got stopped by police, and he had to like, you know, tell him that he forgot his wallet, and I was just like panicking, you know, and he was just like, you know, just keep it chill, you know, but like just things like that are like, you try to suppress now, but like when I think about it, I'm like, damn.
That's traumatizing, yeah. So you were at Bell, you participated in the CalArts film program, and you applied, and you didn't want to go there, obviously, because of the financial burden of like going to a private school like that. Where did you go after high school?
I went to Pasadena City College, and the only reason, because I remember back then I used to get a lot of crap from people like, oh, why didn't you go to ELAC, you know, like, and I was just like, it's not that I'm like looking down on ELAC, it's definitely closer,
but who went to ELAC for 7 years
right, but it was because ELAC didn't have a film production program, and at that point in my dumb mind, and this is another thing, like even in my situation, I always thought that somehow, you know, some way I was going to be able to work in the film industry. So I was like, no, I have to go. If I cannot go to CalArts, I have to go somewhere that's actually teaching me how to make films. And Pasadena had a film production program. And from Carahay, it's one bus that takes you, the one down Atlantic, goes all the way from Carahay to Pasadena.
Are you serious?
Yeah.
So here in my mind, I was picturing you're like transferring multiple buses and like taking the Gold Line or something.
This was before the Gold Line.
Oh, wow.
This was in 2008, 2009. And so there was a bus that went down Atlantic Boulevard that will go from Carahay to Colorado Boulevard in Pasadena. And then from there, you just take another bus that just goes a few blocks to the school.
To school.
So, and that same bus that goes down Atlantic also stops at ELAC. So it will be the same route, basically. You just have to take it longer. But so I was, you know, estaba empecinado that I want to go to PCC. And at this point in my, I was already working in a fast food place in Huntington Park. When I started working there when I was like in 11th grade. So I was already working there.
Oh, wow.
because
it's like a mom and pop restaurant.
No, I don't want to say the brand, but it was.
Of course, shush. We all had to do things to survive.
Yeah, but it's a chain. It's a fast food chain, and it's in HP. It's on Florence and State. And if people know, what restaurants on Florence and State, I worked there for like 7 years. So I was already working there, and, you know, back then it was only AB 540, I think it was in place.
Yep, which turns 20 years old this year.
Amazing. Yeah, crazy. So, you know, I had to work to pay for my classes. Like, I had to literally just pay out of pocket, you know, for the books. And so I would take the bus all the way over there and then come back and then go to work, because I was working the night shift. Like, I was working from, like, 6 p.m. to 2 a.m. every night. Oof. Yeah, so it was on the weekend. So it was a rough time, you know, but I was, like, so blindly thinking, you know, I have to finish this film production course, and I have to do it, and, you know, keep making little films with them. And I feel like that experience was interesting because it was the first time that I was around, you know, gringos, like, you know, white Caucasian, and, you know, people from other like other sort of like backgrounds, you know, that I had not related to in Bell, because in Bell everyone was mostly Mexican or at least Latino. I think there's a small community of like Middle Eastern folks in Bell.
Everybody keeps to themselves for the better part,
You know, so I had no experience hanging out with people from other backgrounds, and I feel like just going over there and also like seeing the difference of like there's an Art House movie theater there that I will go to in school. There's a Lemley's. There's just like, you know,
In and Out. All these other things. There's all the
things that you just don't even.
Like, I think that is the America you pictured when you came over here.
Right, the houses and the sort of like the suburbia, and it's just like a different sort of trip, you know. And
that's quite a trip, honestly, from Cudahy all the way to Pasadena. You're going through so many different communities, and how do you remember how long that bus ride was?
Probably like an hour and a half, 2 hours.
Damn. Yeah. That's a good time. I mean, back then podcasts weren't as big as they are now.
and I had a Razer phone, so it was not an iPhone time for me. I think I got my first iPhone like in 2015, like many, many years later. It was not.
Were you just passing the time reading?
I had an iPod listening to
music. All right. Got your music from Shazam or like Kazaa.
LimeWire, those places.
Damn, I think I relate to you with that on so many levels, because I had the same experience. You go to school part-time, you go to work part-time, and then you have like whatever pieces of a social life you can put together. But yeah, at that age, at that time, at that mindset, it was like, just keep grinding. Like, you're younger. Like, you find the energy and the capacity to want to do it all, and sometimes to be able to do it all. But now, you know, in my 30s and looking back on it, I was like, man, like, that was really hard times.
Yeah, and I feel like, but for me, it was, you know, there were very tough times that, like, I everyone that's undocumented, and if you're young and you're like, what am I doing this for, right? Like, because it's all so uncertain. And even to this day, like, even with DACA, like, you know, with DACA being under fire all the time, like, it's often feels like, you know, like, is this going to pan out? Like,
what? Mochinga, leave it alone.
Yeah, you know? So I remember back then being like, what am I doing all this for? Like, you know, there were days that I was just like, you know, at 2 a.m, cleaning the grease of the fryer after, you know, knowing that I have to go home and, like, write some homework before waking up, like, 5 hours later to go to school. Like, those moments you're like, you know, like, my God, like, what am I doing here, you know? But you just, I feel like just the fact that I didn't have much time for myself was, I don't want to say good, but probably kept me from sort of like getting into my head or whatnot. Because, you know, it's tough. It was just like, you know, and if occasionally you have like, you know, you ask for a weekend and then you go to a party with friends, or you know, you hang out here and there and sort of like you find those moments of like levity and, you know, relaxation, but yeah, it was some tough years for sure.
Do you think in that same light, being so busy and like keeping your eye on the ball of like, I gotta get through this, that kept you, like you were saying earlier, out of trouble and like doing other things, like, you know, pisteando, like getting too comfortable and things like that?
Yeah, and I also feel like, for better or worse, the notion that I was not welcome in this country always made me feel that I have to be good. I have to go under the radar. I have to behave. I cannot do anything.
You gotta work twice as hard.
Because otherwise, you know. And like, my aunt was, you know, very loving, but she was also tough in the sense that she was not, she was not gonna be okay with me. You know, that was another thing too. Like, I didn't have my parents right, so it was like, as much as I love my aunt and she loves me, like, it was a different type of relationship because not my parents. Like, they're not gonna put up with my shit, you know. And she'd be like, "Well, just go back to your parents." Like, I don't, you know, like if I was misbehaving, you know, or so. I always felt like I had to sort of like be, you know, as best as I could. And I'm not saying I never did anything stupid, you know. Like,
no, we were all young,
you know, but it wasn't at the level that I would see other friends, you know.
Like, just wilding out.
Yeah, or like not going to school, or, you know.
Like, bro, you paid for this. That was my main motivation for school.
In college, yeah, for sure. In high school, I guess not, but in college, it was like, I'm paying for this. I was not missing classes. I do not want to retake anything, because anything that you retake, it's paying again for, you know. Mm-hmm. For the tuition, and you had to buy the books, and, you know, I had to buy the bus pass. Like, I remember, like, this, my God, I hadn't thought about these things. Like, I remember I had to, like, go to the Bell Library, because you could get a discount on your monthly bus pass there. So I remember I had to go there every month to buy my bus pass, because I needed it to.
Oh, that's right, when they were still paper passes, yeah. Mm-hmm.
So those kind of things, you know, you think about, you're like, all this is costing me, you know, time and money, and, like, I don't want to sort of, like, throw it away. And it still took me 4 years to finish an AA at Pasadena, because I was doing it, you know, a few classes per semester, both because of time, but also because of money, you know. So, like, and so by the time I ended there, it was 2012.
And that's when DACA came around.
It was, I think I was graduating the same year that DACA came out.
Yeah.
Or the same week. It was in June. I graduated in June from PCC, and it was just, yeah. I remember the day, it was sort of like a life-changing day for a lot of people, for many, many people.
Yeah, but for me, it was just being hungover. Because I was partying the day before. And then I'm like, trying to get from my friend's house home to go change and shower so I can go somewhere else. And I was just hungover waiting for the bus, and I was looking through Twitter, and then I saw the news. I was like, oh, shit, like, cool. Like, this happened. Mm. I was like, to me, that is like, yeah, that's me. I was hungover. I was trying to go home when it happened. How long did you wait before applying, once, like, the news broke out and everything?
A month or less.
Really? Wow.
Yeah.
So you had all the, like, the papers y todo to prove?
Well, I think I remember, like, maybe, like, a couple weeks after, we went to see, I don't even know if it was a lawyer. It was, you know, those places that do, like, taxes, but also
had, notary.
Like, immigration lawyers. Yeah. People. So we went, and, like, they told us, like, all the things that we needed, and, like, I had, like, every little diploma that I ever got from school for, like, you know, perfect attendance or things like that.
Yeah,
in Bell High School, you know, all my, you know.
That's cool you kept all of that,
all my grades and all that. And so we just, you know, we did it right away. I think I actually probably applied, like, in August of that year. So maybe, like, a month and a half.
Wow, so almost, like, right away, as soon as they released, like, the guidelines, what you need to apply. Yeah. And as soon as they opened the doors for people to start applying.
Yeah, it was very, very early on. Yeah.
How were you feeling, like, when you got everything together, you put your packet together, you know, your money order, his, like, $500, cabrones, give me my fucking, like, work permit.
$500, and it's like, we still don't know we're going to give you.
Yeah.
It's just for the application. You know, I was, to be honest, I was feeling just hopeful. Like, it was just, you know, anything. Like, having nothing to having something, it's a big, big privilege, big difference, you know, to, like, because, you know, I also talk about this with some people, you know, like, and I'm sure you probably relate. Like, I remember when I was, you know, 21, 22, like, going to clubs and having to pull out my passport. Or before that, the matricula, you know, that, like, and it was, like, it was embarrassing at times. Like, and I'm not saying that I'm not embarrassed from where I'm from or not, but, like, people would look at you, you know.
The judgment.
Like, even friends, like, be like, oh, like, the people, friends that weren't so close that didn't know my full story, I will have to be like, or, like, you know, I remember people will invite, like, you know, their white friends or friends from other communities. They're like, why do you have a passport, you know? Or, like, what is this other matricula thing that, like, you know, like, or you have to be carrying the big passport in your pocket to get into a club, to have a beer at a bar, you know? Like, those are things that, like, you know, they're funny, but at the same time, they're like, fuck. Like, you know, they're like, I don't want to say humiliating, but they alienate you, right?
They do.
They show that you're different than everyone else.
What do you call it? It's a scarlet letter.
Right. And it's not, and it's clearly, like, not because you're visiting from Mexico. Like, when my cousins or someone comes from Mexico and they use their passport, yeah, they're tourists, but, like, you know, people know that you live here and that you're using a passport, and they start questioning, or, you know, so I remember, like, one of those things, it was as silly as, like, oh my God, I'm going to be able to have a California ID and not have to show my passport and, like, not be, you know, sort of like be able to not be immediately identify as you know, an immigrant or whatnot.
It's a big difference. Yeah,
I know, of course, I wanted to work and I felt like, you know, maybe there would be more opportunities. And I also had applied right after college, again, stupidly, just because I was like, well, you know, you never know. I applied to Chapman University, which is another private school that has a very famous film program. And I got into the film production program. But then, you know, I tried to like sort of like see if it was even feasible to like get money and pay for it. It was just the amounts of money that they, it's like, you know, $50,000 a year, which is like, it's money that like it wasn't like it wasn't even in my,
that's even more than USC,
you know, it's crazy money, you know. So it was just like, you know, it was not gonna happen. But I was like, you know, maybe with DACA now I could do something else, you know. So
it's like you said, it brought you that hope.
Yeah, it was hope, you know, which is more than most people can say, sadly.
Yeah, man, I remember at one point all the homies and I, we were just like drinking and messing around and just really just frustrated with the same like passport matricula situation, that we were all like, let's make an Excel sheet with all the places that are like matricula friendly, so that way, like, you know, it can help you avoid some of that embarrassment and like cringiness of like trying to go to a bar and then like they're asking you for this stuff.
Yeah, I mean, of course, back then when I was working at, I was about to say the name, when I was working at this fast food place, in Huntington Park, we would go to La Boom. Oh my god!
Oh wow!
La Boom was not. They didn't care if you had a matricula or a passport, or whatever. You know, just
like, you're old enough to be here.
Yeah, maybe. You know? Maybe. So those places didn't matter, but it was when like you're trying to go to Long Beach or you're trying to go to like this little bar in Pasadena that a friend invited you to, or in, you know, in Hollywood or whatnot, that you have to pull your passport and your matricula. And I remember it was also like you had to find like a consulado sobre ruedas, or you had Plaza Mexico, like all those things that is like people don't even know the hassles, like, because like you have to take like a morning off or like a day off.
I mean, I just referred to it as the Mexican DMV,
right?
Prepare to be there all day.
Right.
Truly. Bring your lunch, bring all your paperwork, so you don't have to like come back another day, be there all day, read a book or something. But I mean, the good thing was at least they gave you your passport or your ID the same day.
Right away, right? Yeah.
So, jeez. Oh, my God. So many awkward times with the matricula. So I wanted to ask you. So you graduated from PCC. You know, you have DACA. You have new opportunities coming your way. Well, I think you were also sharing when something that I read, that around this time, you also started writing for free. For a publication, right? For like an indie publication, and start putting your foot in the door and being a critic. How can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Yeah, it started, I think, around that same time. I first started writing for myself. I made like a Blogspot blog.
Hey, I still have mine.
Mine still exists, and I won't say the name because I just saw it, and it's just so dumb. Like, it was just like, I cringe at reading the writing back then. But anyway, but it's still there.
I do too.
So I was writing for myself, and I remember like I was just going to the movies by myself, paying my own ticket whenever I had time, and then going home and like writing a review on a movie that no one read. Like, it was honestly just for myself, and I probably would share it on like Facebook or something, but like I don't think anyone really read it.
No, I mean, there's folks, you'd be surprised how much, like, if you just put it out there, somebody will find it.
So that was sort of like the first thing, writing for myself. And then there was a Craigslist ad, which is you know, kind of the craziest way to find a gig, because at this point you gotta understand that I had no idea how the film industry worked. Like, I had no idea how criticism worked. How do you even get a job? Like, I had no context, no one that knows, works in the industry, in my family, no one has any idea.
You didn't have that connection, yeah.
Yeah, nothing. You know, my cousins, both of them are like, well, both of them are engineers, you know, and so it's like the film industry and entertainment were not part of anyone in the family. So I had no idea. Like, I applied to this thing, you know, I knew I wanted to write about movies, and they said, we're looking for, you know, someone to review films. There's no pay, but you'll get exposure.
You get free popcorn.
Right. Sometimes. And so I was like, okay, sure. And it was then that I discovered that there were, you know, screenings for critics to watch these movies ahead of time. And that was, even that was unknown to me. Like, I just, you know, because I remember when these guys like, okay, you're going to go see this movie here, and then at this location, which all the screening rooms to this day, they're all like in Beverly Hills and like in like secret buildings, you know,
on the west side. Yeah.
And I remember taking the bus for like fucking 3 hours, you know, taking the 111 to the blue line to the red line to Wilshire, and then Wilshire taking the bus, the red bus that goes down Wilshire Boulevard. So it was like a whole odyssey. And I did that for a long time when I was starting out, like just going to from Carahue to those screenings. But so when he offered me this movie review, I remember asking him, you know, like, oh, how do I get the tickets? I thought that they were going to give me physical tickets because yeah. I had no idea. He was like, what tickets? Like, someone will have you on the list. And that to me was like, you know, oh, like I didn't know what a publicist was. Like, I honestly was just like not aware of how this worked.
Learning as you go.
Yeah, because how are you supposed to know if you know, those are things that are like very insular, mm-hmm. and, you know, only mm-hmm. for the people that are in the game. And I feel like now that has gotten better with like Twitter and social media, people share so much.
Oh, yeah.
We're very open. But back then it wasn't. And yeah, so that's how I started writing reviews for these. I think it was called Scream Picks. That might have been the name of it.
I think when there were more online sites like that.
Yeah, it was a small site, but it was big enough that they were getting on the list. You know, like I was going to screenings, and you know, at this point, like I was just doing it because it was something to do. I was in school anymore. I had graduated from PCC, and I was still working at this fast food place. So it was a thing to do, you know, like I would get off my shift in the morning because at this point I had managed to like move to the morning shift. Mm. So I was doing the morning shift at this place. And then in the afternoons, I would go to the screenings and then write a review the next morning before my shift. You know, it was never meant like to be a career because I was like, I don't even know how this turns into a career. Like it was never in my mind to turn it as a career. I was like, I'm going to do this and see what happens, you know. And yeah, so it started with that website. And then eventually I found a website in Iceland they were looking for someone in LA to review things for them, and they weren't paying anything, but they had a lot of contacts and a lot of followers back then. For me, was like they had like 10,000 followers, and to me that was an immense amount of followers.
Still kind
of
is, yeah.
So I remember I would milk that so much. Like I would email publicists, be like, "Oh, I write for this website that has 10,000 followers," like thinking that it was, you know, big.
You gotta have that confidence. Yeah.
So then I started just writing for this website, and I remember I went to like my first film festival with the LA Film Festival that back then happened in downtown LA, and yeah. I sort of like getting into those spaces at first. You know, I started going to junkets, and a junket is sort of like an event that studios have for new releases, in which they invite all the press and they have like round tables with you know, with talent, or mm-hmm, they have like interviews mm-hmm. with like directors or actors. So I started going to those junkets and, you know, getting into it a little bit more until around the same time, I got an internship at a company called Strand Releasing. They're a distributor. They distribute international films. And they weren't paying, but they were so nice to me. And that I feel like they really brought me into like the fold of like, how does the industry work? Like, how distribution works? You know, the posters and the things. And I was there for like a year. And, you know, eventually, it was just one of those things that was very serendipitous because the owner of Strand Releasing, Marcus, who has always been a great supporter of me, he had a friend at the Sundance Institute who was looking for an intern. Mm. No, they were looking for an assistant, actually. And he was like, you should go interview. And to me, it was like, incredible, right? So I went for an interview at the Sundance Institute. I remember, like,
and you got a foot in the door with somebody putting your name in there.
Right. So I went to this interview to be an assistant. And of course, you know, they were very nice, but like I had no experience to be an assistant. I couldn't be an assistant to anyone. Like I was like, you know, I don't know anything. You know, I know movies and I know how to watch movies. I like to write movies, but I don't know how to, you know, help an executive, you know?
Well, yeah, because when I hear assistant, I think some of the stereotypical things that most of us see from the outside in of like, oh, you're an assistant, so that means you're like the go-getter. Go get me this, go get me that, right? Mm-hmm. Go do this, do that.
Yeah. But, you know, this one was more like, you know, you need to like handle my agenda or things like that. Like,
oh,
more
your schedule, like, appointments. Yeah,
like, it was like a big deal assistant, you know? And I was like, you know, but I remember that during that interview, they also asked me about what kind of films I like. And, you know, I talked about some international films and, you know, things like that. So then
you weren't saying you like Adam Sandler movies?
I did not. and so that happened, right? So then I got a very nice email saying that I wasn't getting that position. And then somehow I had the sort of like, you know, the gut to reply and say like, oh, thank you for letting me know. If there's any, if there's ever any other position or possibility, let me know. And I remember like 2 months later, I got an email from from someone at Sundance, Shira Rockowitz. And she asked me if I would be interested in applying to be an intern at the Sundance Institute. And so I went for an interview with her, and, you know, she was incredible. She talked to me, and I will always be thankful, because a lot of the interns that, you know, that were around at the time were like people from USC, people from, you know, big name schools. And I show up with like a degree from an AA from,
hey, what's up, everybody?
From Pasadena City College, right? And like no real credentials other than, you know, my passion for film. And I always feel like she took a chance on me just based on meeting me and, like, you know, reading my, because I had already a couple of reviews out there, reading my reviews. And, you know, just it was one of those moments in which I felt that someone really saw me beyond, you know, the resume of, like, because on paper it's like, this guy has an AA from Pasadena City College on humanities or some like random stuff, right? And I got an internship at the Sundance Institute, which was definitely pretty life changing. I still work for them as a contractor now, even now.
Wow.
Like 8-9 years later.
Hell yeah, that's a good plug to have.
Yeah, so they've always been very incredible to me. And around the same time, all these things happened, like IndieWire and Roger Ebert.
Two thumbs up, Roger Ebert.
Right, Roger Ebert's wife. Roger Ebert had just passed away, and his wife, in his honor, started this fellowship called the Roger Ebert Fellowship. And it was the first year that they were doing it, and I applied, and they chose 6 film critics, and they will pay your way to go to Sundance. So it was incredible. Like, I went to Sundance as best part
Utah
of
Utah Sundance.
Yeah, yeah, at the actual festival. And I went, and yeah, it was, that was probably the real sort of like big break for me, going, being part of this, you know, group of 6 other young critics, and learning at a real big festival, doing reviews and meeting all the players, meeting all the big, you know, critics at the time, programmers, filmmakers.
Yeah.
Being sort of going, not just going by myself, but going as part of this group that they were parading us through, like meeting the actual people. We were actually being introduced to the real players. Right? Like, it wasn't like I was just going by myself, like as a nobody. Like, I was part of this fellowship, and like people were interested in meeting us, and I met editors there, and sort of like that started. That's where I feel like I got the confidence to, you know, later start pitching to other places and sort of, you know, grow from there.
Yeah, I mean, to best summarize that what is an like most internships should be doing, giving you that confidence, those skills, those networking pathways for you to be able to keep moving forward in your career, right? And growing as a writer, as a critique, I mean, as a critiquer, as a film critic, director, what have you, right? Because I imagine, were the other cohorts in the group also film critics?
Yeah, there were 6 of us.
All right, so everybody was film critic. Cool.
But I do remember that all of them were, you know, Caucasian, and I hesitate saying white because they look at me. You know?
Can say blanquitos.
Right, but you know, they were gringos, and I do remember just there were. I mean, we're still friends, all 6 of us, which is incredible too. That, but I do remember feeling like they had come from a very different place, you know, like they all had graduated from, you know, major colleges, and they all had, you know, even sort of like, master's degrees, you know, like they had gone to like, like graduate school.
Yeah.
They had gone to graduate school. Like, they were like really like have like, you know, degrees in, double degrees in like English literature and like all these things, you know, that sound really impressive. And I was just here like, you know, always trying to like, I don't want to say undermine myself, but like, it was, what do I say, right? When like people are talking about like, oh, I went to the school and I have these degrees. Like, where did you go? And I'm like, well, I went to Pasadena.
PCC, what's up?
I wish I had that confidence, and I hope that now maybe I have it more. But at that moment, like, again, this was remember that before I told everyone in the film industry that I was a DACA recipient, right? Like, I feel like at that moment, everyone just thought, you know, whatever, like, this person's from Mexico, but they don't even have any notion of like, what does that mean?
Yeah, you didn't give him any, right? So I'll tell you that the confidence of like being, you know, proud of where we come, our situations, our struggles, comes in time. And for me, it came with age too, of like, I revel in that feeling of being in those spaces of like, oh, you went to here, you have this, that, 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 that's your title. I went to ELAC for 7 years and we're in the same space. What's up? It doesn't mean anything that you have all these titles. Sure, you paid a lot of money for them, but it says more that I'm here with you at the same space, right? And we're doing this and we're still moving forward in our careers. So that, I mean, kudos to you, like that everything happened and aligned and you got all these opportunities and that you were able to create a career for yourself as a film critic.
Yeah, which is, you know, it's crazy to even say that, to even think that, you know, because it feels just so unfeasible coming from where I come from, for, you know, from those sort of places that these careers feel like they're not for me, they're for someone else. Yeah. They're a million miles away, you know, like, and
they look like they're for somebody else.
Right. And to sort of be, you know, around those people and in those places and at a festival like Sundance, you know, it feels, yeah, I remember just being sort of like overwhelmed with like not believing that I was there, you know.
From that time you went to Sundance, was there a movie you remember seeing and be like, damn, like that, like this is why I do this?
That's that first year, I think, and it's funny, people are going to be like, really, that one? There was a movie called The Voices, which it's on HBO Max if you want to watch it. It's a very weird movie. It's a movie about a serial killer, but it's a comedy. It's like a very dark comedy. And
okay.
It was by a director, Marjan Satrapi, who had done an animated film called Persepolis before.
I love that movie. Right. Yeah.
So that same director then made this movie called The Voices, which is with Ryan Reynolds. And
all right, you kind of already have my attention there.
Which I think it's the best thing Ryan Reynolds has ever done, in my opinion. And it's called The Voices, and it's like a very dark comedy that people really didn't care for. But I was just really taken by it. And I remember I got to interview the director. You know, that was another thing for me that was just very sort of like shocking, when I got to actually interview people that I had admired. You know, being in the room with them, like asking them questions, and like sort of like being, I don't want to say being seen as equals, but like, you know, having at least their attention enough for them to like take my questions seriously and like engaging with them in a place. You know, like there was like a film director that, like, you know, that I interviewed, and I was like, oh my god, if you only knew that, like, I saw your movie for the first time on a bootleg DVD in Mexico City. That
they would appreciate that.
That I bought for like 5 pesos, you know, because it was another way to see it, you know, and, like, or I think I skipped like a very big chapter in my film. And I'm gonna go back to it if you don't mind.
No.
When I was like 11 or 12, that couple of last few years that I was in Mexico, I convinced my mom to enter this contest. And I talked about it on Twitter too. There was a contest for a Mexican movie theater chain, Cinepolis, was doing, which I think they're now in the U.S. too.
Yeah, they're still around.
Right. They had a contest to guess the winners of the 5 main awards of the Oscars that year. And so my mom entered the contest, and we got them all right, and we won. And the prize for that was a card that would allow you to go to the movies for free for a year.
Oh, this is MoviePass before MoviePass.
Right, but it was for free, yeah, for a year in any movie theater that was associated with them. And they had like other multi-cinemas. They had like a bunch of different smaller chains that also belonged to them. And you could use it for any movie, every day, for two people. And it was... And I remember, like, because it was under my mom's name because I was so young, like, for me to use it by myself, they told my mom that she had to give me her ID. So I would show up to the theater, like, every day after school. I would take the bus to go to, like, Reforma, because that's what they were playing, all the international or weird movies that I wanted to watch. So I would, like, after school, like, I would take the bus and, like, with this card and, like, watch a movie. So I watch every day. I would watch movies there, watch movies on the weekends with my brother. And, like, we milked that thing to...
Hell yeah.
Like, just watch so much. And I feel like that was definitely a big, big life-changing moment for me, because when the issue of money is no longer an issue, you could take risk in watching all these movies, right? Yeah. So I was more adventurous because it wasn't costing me. So I was watching movies from Afghanistan, movies from France.
Get the cuesta, just time.
Right. So I was, and I was a kid, you know, so I was just watching, I would watch movies twice, you know, I would go back.
I'm getting this visual idea in my mind's eye of you watching the movie, you know, and it's like you being smaller, younger, and you're eating your torta and you're watching this international movie.
And it was, you know, it was incredible. Like, just when there was no issue of money, like, just the access that I had to, like, movies, and sometimes, because it was for two people, so sometimes I would invite, like, a friend from school, you know, my brother, my little brother would go with me, and it could be anywhere in the city. So it was just, like, an incredible thing that happened to us, that, you know, it was, like, just the most sort of, like, magical thing that I think about, and I'm like, yeah, that was, like, a big like a big deal for me winning that thing and just milking it to, you know, to the debt. Like, we really used it a lot. And so I feel like even back then, like, I was like, I would get a movie ticket for a regular movie, and then I was sneak into a movie that it was like rated R that I couldn't see, and I would just see something that I wasn't supposed to see, you know.
Democratize the movie theaters.
Yeah, so that was a big deal for me back when, and I feel like all those things have sort of, like, you know, returned now that I'm in this place now, you know, meeting the directors whose movies I saw for free with this car, you know, and like just a lot of things just feels kind of surreal that you don't imagine, you know, when back when.
I can only imagine how you feel about that and having this, like, very, like, profound feeling of, like, man, I went from watching you on bootleg to, like, here I am talking to you at this film festival, you know, and you are on the other side. You're writing about them. You're asking them all these questions. So that's awesome to hear. But I did want to come back to that, what you've referenced a few times already, that in this whole time of, like, you going to the Sundance internship, being there, already starting, you know, the foundation of your career, that folks didn't know, or you didn't let folks know, as I understand it, that you were undocumented, that you had DACA, or even sharing those experiences. But in 2017, you wrote a piece pretty much putting yourself out there. How did that come about?
It was right after it was rescinded, when
That Pendejo came in office, yeah.
Right, so he, you know, it was a very, you know, scary moment, like, when, you know, he basically blocked new applications and we didn't know, you know, what was going to happen with it. And I just felt like, for a lot of people that appreciated me in the industry, that, you know, were always in my corner but didn't know this big part of my story, it would sort of, like, make it not be hypothetical, right? Like, if, because a lot of these people don't know anyone that's a DACA recipient, like, in their circles they don't hang out, they don't know anyone, you know. They know the folks at the Mexican restaurants, or, like, people, you know, in the service industry.
They know, like as you said, they know of it,
right? But they never interacted, or they never imagined that someone that's in the same spaces as them might be one of these people that they hear in the news, the DACA recipients, the dreamers, you know. So to me, it was a way of, like, sort of, like, bringing it to the industry in the sense that, like, I'm one of those people, right? Like, it doesn't, like, if you say you care about me or that you appreciate my work, and it's, you know, it's no longer hypothetical. It's not, well, it's not anymore those people that I've never met. It's like someone that you've actually met, and you've read my work, and you've interacted with me.
At you know festivals. Me. Yeah.
So it was important for me at that moment, because it felt like it was the only thing I could really do in terms of, like, you know, sort of sharing my story, sharing my sort of perspective on what that means, you know, and sort of, like, being in this space with that looming over your head, right? Because, and this, I always feel sort of, like, silly saying this, because there's so many people with so many bigger problems, you know, people that don't even qualify for DACA, you know, which is a big thing. I feel like DACA recipients, we get a lot of attention when, like, there's so many people. I have friends who got here when they were 17, and by 1 year, they no longer qualify, you know? So with that caveat, I will say that I think that, you know, in this space that happens often is that, from a few years back, you know, when I started getting a little bit of recognition, maybe 2015, 2016, I was getting invited to a lot of international festivals, a lot. Like, I was getting, you know, which is a dream, you know, like, I've always dreamed of
going to Cannes.
Yeah, or, like, going, like, you know, the Czech Republic or Australia or Greece, and they were going to pay for me to fly to this place and be on the jury, or, you know, so those things. And every time I would have to write this very sad email for me, explaining to them that I could not leave. And I remember back then, I used to be more vague. I'm like, oh, my immigration situation is complicated, you know. Like, now I just tell them straight up, like, I'm a DACA recipient. Because it still happens. It just, like, a couple weeks ago, someone were like, oh, you want to go to Russia? And I was like, I would love to, but I cannot leave the country. Like, you know, I just can't, you know.
It's not that simple.
Right, you know, so it's silly to complain, like, oh, my God, I cannot travel
internationally. No, it's totally understandable for folks like us. Yeah, as you said, right, there are folks who have it harder, but we can't get caught up in the oppression Olympics,
right?
Our own fears and experiences are just as valid, even though they're just as different. So I think that's something, you know, that we all have to figure out for ourselves.
Right, and I feel like it's still to this day, you know, like, every time, like, the Cannes Film Festival comes around or the Toronto Film Festival comes around, and, like, all my colleagues are like, we're going to the festival, I'm excited for the festival, and I'm like, yeah, even if I, you know, because they're like, oh, you should save money, and I'm like, yeah, even if I save the money, I physically will be, you know, it'll be very complicated for me to get, you know, the parole or whatever. Mm-hmm. It'd just be like a whole mm-hmm. thing, and mm-hmm. I'm just very nervous about that, you know. So like things like that like people don't understand. So like in the piece that you're referring to, like it was just me, and it wasn't even a piece that I wrote for a website. I put it on my Facebook wall, and then the outlets came and they're like, can we republish this?
Oh wow.
I put it on my Facebook. It was just like a Facebook post, and then the rap and other places you know, asked me if they could republish it as a, you know, as a blog post for them, because it was just on my Facebook page. It wasn't like something that I had put out there as a piece. It was just on my Facebook for the people that already followed me on Facebook.
In your circles, yeah. Right.
Who didn't know that about me, because I would never really post about that part of me, you know. Now, of course, I'm much more open about it, like everything at length about that in different pieces. Like there was a piece about Roma that I wrote in like 2018, and you know, having not gone back to Mexico. I think
that Roma, the movie that launched the thousand think pieces.
Right. My think piece of the thousands was about how not going, like having not going back to Mexico, and sort of like the city that I remember no longer exists because it has changed so much. Mm. And that the city that's in the movie, it's basically the city that my mom remembers when she was, you know, younger. You know, and sort of like that. What happens when you no longer remember a place, and what is that meaning of home? Is like, what's home anymore? You know, because like, you know, that sort of like identity crisis of like, you know, am I? Of course, I'm always gonna be Mexican, but at the same time, it's like, you know, am I still fully of there, or am I partly here now? You know, so
it's complicated. Yeah, I mean, it gets a lot more complicated the older you get. Because I think for me at least, I have better understanding and deeper understanding of all these shifting dynamics and what it means to really remember space and be attached to it and how we want to remember it, and coming to terms with different things for like for us, right? That there still might be a few more years before we are able to return back and see it for what it was and kind of go down that nostalgia trip. But I mean, yeah, it's one of those other things también that as individuals we all have to find our place of comfort with it and just, you know, to kind of keep moving forward. So yeah, that was awesome. Definitely a great piece that you put out. What was, I mean, and you said you put it out on Facebook first, but what was like some of the reactions you were getting from folks, from your colleagues, from friends that didn't know that you were undocumented and now you were undocumented? What was the feedback you were getting?
It was very positive. Yeah. I feel like people were just very supportive and very, you know, just shocked. A lot of them were like not, you know, they didn't even think
I
that.
I didn't know.
Right, because again, they don't expect anyone that's undocumented or documented to be part of these spaces. Like it just doesn't register. Like if you're in these spaces, you must be, you know, illegally here mm-hmm. or whatnot. You know, you must be a citizen or a resident, you know. So it didn't even cross their mind. So I feel like a lot of them were shocked, but they were overwhelmingly positive and supportive.
That's awesome.
Of, you know. Of sort of like learning what that journey is like, and you know how it's just a different sort of path to come from that to enter these spaces, and what does that mean, you know, for someone like me or the people that even want to do it, you know.
Well, hopefully that also meant that people stopped asking you about film festivals.
It hasn't happened, you know. And it's like a double-edged thing, right? Because it makes me feel very it kind of proud when people are like, "Oh, they're considering me to go to this place. I wish I could go."
As you should be,
you know. I wish I could go, and if I could, I would. You know, I would.
Hey, do man, it in we're in the pandemic. Like, send me the Zoom link.
Right. So. You know, but I've gotten invited to, you know, festivals here in the U.S. too. So I'm going to Virginia soon and to to Key West, you know, to be part of this festival. So
I mean, we still got 50 states we can go visit.
Right. So
that's awesome. Another piece I wanted to talk to you about was the one you put out earlier this year in July for Vox, where it's a mix of you kind of putting yourself out there again that, you know, you're undocumented, you're documented, and getting into a little bit of that experience, but focusing more on your career as a critic and what that has been like these last couple of years as you've grown, you know, from being in an internship to writing for different publications to now a lot of big name places, and what you've seen over the years in terms of like gatekeeping, racism, the critic spaces in general, and like some of the issues that are with it. How did that piece come about?
You know, it was interesting because that piece, they asked me, you know, they had a, they were doing a an issue, a digital issue on gatekeeping.
Okay.
And they wanted to do one on film criticism. And I think I'd posted, probably tweeted something, you know. That's one of those things I feel like Twitter has definitely gotten me a lot of gigs just by tweeting whatever I think about something. And
really, because so, it just gets me in trouble.
So they came to me and they asked if I would want to do a piece on criticism and gatekeeping and my own story. So that's, you know, that's how it came about. And then I talked to another a few other, you know, people that, you know, were from underrepresented communities or people of color. And I talked to them about their experiences, you know, and just sort of blending what they shared with mine. And how, you know, it's, like I said, like the first time I went to a screening, like I felt very out of place because I just, all these people knew each other. They're in a clique. They're part of this community. And you're sort of like the outsider coming in. And then that you get into like the politics of it all. Like, you know, most, the value is placed on the publication you're writing for more than you as a writer, right? So if you're writing for a big publication, you get more access, you know, and who writes for those publications? There's usually people that are in the establishment, you know, very highly educated, you know, white American folks and who have been there for a long time. So it's just a perpetuating thing of like, you know, you only get opportunities if you write for these places, but to write for these places, you know, there's a lot of gatekeeping that goes there and sort of like, how do you even navigate that and what does that mean, right? And then there's also the part of like, for me, that I love writing about Latino film, whether it's the U.S. Latino or Latin American or Mexican or Mexican American, you know, the full spectrum of what Latinidad is in terms of film. That's really something that I really love. And, you know, I think it started a lot with like me writing for Remezcla. I mean, I was always interested, but Remezcla was like a very important platform for me back when Vanessa Erazo, who I just want to shout out.
Different times. Yeah.
She was the film editor at Remezcla, you know, who built up that section and who would give us a space to write about, in, you know, indie films, like not only like the big, you know, Diego Luna, Gael Garcia Bernal movies, but like the indie film that was playing at the San Diego Latino Film Festival, or that was playing at this other, you know, a short film that was about, you know, Mexican American person or a documentary, you know. And so I really enjoy that. But at some point, when you do that, you know, it tends to feel like sometimes you get pigeonholed, right?
Yeah.
That you only get to write about those things, especially at the major outlets, you know, which is cool. Like, you do want to be, you know, it's sort of like a balancing of like, you want to represent, you want to sort of uplift those voices and highlight, you know, the talent from that community. But at the same time, you also have other interests, right? Like, I love animation, and sometimes I just want to write about animated films. I love international films from South Korea or Iran or, you know, wherever, you know, and I just want to write about those sometimes, you know. So how do you balance that and not of being a voice for things that you care about, but also sort of like not being, you know,
just limited to that.
Being a token of sort of like the system in terms of like, you know, you are the Latino writer and you only write about these things, right?
Yep.
So I feel like there's so much of like those things that you have to navigate when you come from a community that hasn't been always, you know, represented in those spaces, you know? Because I remember like when I started, like, I think the only other, you know, person of a Latino background that I could think of in that space was Claudia Puig, who's Mexican American and who's the president of the Los Angeles Film Critics Association. You know, she was the only one, at least with a substantial sort of like recognized career, right? Because of course there's like many others that, like, you know, have their own blogs and things like that, but that's someone that had been able to sort of like enter those spaces in a meaningful way, you know. And so when there's that, you're like, well, there's no real precedent. There's, you know, there's no real, how do you even apply to these things? Mm-hmm, how do you become a member of these things? What is that? You know, is there value in my writing, or is there value in my writing only when it's published at these places, right? Because like sometimes for Remezcla, I can say that I did a lot of my best writing for Remezcla, but it was often not as appreciated or as, you know, well received because it was coming from an outlet that was seen as they only write about Latinos. So, you know, it was harder to get access.
And it wasn't exclusive to movies either.
Right. And it was harder to get access, to get talent, you know, like when the big name directors or actors are giving interviews, their publicists usually want them to talk to the Variety, the Hollywood Reporters, you know, the big places. Yeah, they don't really care for these smaller outlets, you know. And I feel like with time, those things have changed, you know. And I feel like it just it's difficult to navigate all these things. And when you, because people often ask, you know, like, how do people get into this? I'm like, it's also like, when I started out, you don't get paid, so you have to have another job. And a lot of people don't have the time to, like, have their 9-to-5 and then, you know, take care of the kids and then watch a movie and then write a review. Like, you know, it's a very sort of, like, difficult place to even enter, because at the beginning, you'll be getting paid either nothing or a couple bucks for a review or for a piece, right?
Yeah.
So just financially, it's not viable for a lot of people to do this. So that, again, limits who can even engage in this place, you know. A lot of people create their own websites, but, you know, does that make money? You know, you have to invest time. So just a lot of things that, you know, I try to at least, you know, brush at the surface in that piece and sort of, like, question, who's responsible for this? Is it the editor? The editor's giving more chances to new voices? Is it the publicist, you know, also giving access to other voices, to people that don't often get to write about movies? So it's a whole thing.
No, I mean, and that perfectly encapsulates it, that it's like any other profession, right? If you're not about it 100%, if that's not going to be your career, then, you know, trying to do it part time or at a passing glance is not gonna be, it's not gonna be a positive experience overall. Like, you really have to, like, put a lot of extra effort. And I don't like using this term and this phrasing, but, you know, as folks say, like, you quote unquote pay your dues to, like, you know, get in that space.
But yeah, but even then, you have to think about, like, who can afford to pay the dues?
Exactly.
Right? Who can even have the time to, like, work for free? Or work for very little money and spend the time to go watch a movie at a screening and then come home and write the review and, you know, while you have a 9-to-5, you know, like, mm-hmm. Today, like, even now, as a freelancer who, you know, I'm very lucky to write for some really cool places on a regular basis, I still have other gigs that have nothing to do with writing about film, you know, because I need money, you know. Yeah. Sometimes I do translation for press releases, you know, like, I'm lucky that I've always kept my Spanish to writing and reading, so I can translate back and forth between English and Spanish, so I can get a little money from doing that.
I was reading that you're a screener, también.
And I read screenplays for Sundance or for other places. I've read, you know, applications. So, like, you know, I'm lucky that most of the things that I do are related to film, even if they're not film criticism, per se. But I still have to have other gigs, you know, because I'm still a freelancer that, you know, you get your money. Money doesn't come right away. You have to wait for your money, and it's a whole thing that things that, like, you know, don't feel as glamorous. And, you know, I don't know if this happens to you, but one thing for me is also that it's very hard sometimes to explain to my family what I do and how I make a living of it, right? Because they just don't have any concept of, like, well, you don't go to an office, you don't go to the place,
you get paid to watch movies,
right? And to write about them, and who's paying you for this, and then you travel to this place. Yeah. And so, you know, it's like, it's one of those things that, like, it's hard to even the measure of success, like, and I had to come to terms with that, you know, for myself. Like, sometimes I feel like, you know, I wish that, you know, family, other people really understood how meaningful, like, when I got into the New York Times, like, to me, that was like, you know, like, this is such a monumental thing for me and for, like, you know, I don't want to say for the family, but, like, you know, and I feel like for the people that don't grasp what that means, it's just like, the measure of success is different, especially for immigrant communities, mm-hmm. or, you know.
It's not that visual labor.
Right. Yeah. And it's also like, you don't have a house yet. So that's, you know, success is like the house, the kids, the big truck, the big car, the backyard with a, you know, with a pool and
mm-hmm.
the,
all these very visual things.
Right. You know, so that's the measure of success for a lot of immigrant parents or immigrant families, you know. And so when you're doing something different, that to me, the measure of success is like, I got into the fucking New York Times, you know, which is incredible for someone like me, and it wasn't received as I thought it would be. And I was like, but I also gotta understand that the mentality is different, it's, you know, different. And it's
priorities,
like, yeah, you know. So, like, it's one of those things, like, yeah, well, maybe the house will never happen, but, you know, I was in the New Times, like, there's, you know, there's, you're building something else, something different, right? Like, even making it as a possibility for other people to even,
oh my god, yeah, the doors you are not only creating, but are leaving behind you as you keep moving forward in your career, right? That in very much a similar way, you know, you were given opportunities through internships and all these other places. You know, you are, it sounds to me like you are continuing that what, you know, was given to you, you're going to be reciprocal and try to do the same for others.
Absolutely, yeah. So I'm always, you know, very receptive when people message me or invited me to be on podcasts or on things, you know, because I feel like, you know, that's only all you can do is sort of like try to share and explain to people that, you know, that maybe it's not so unrealistic, that maybe it can be done, you know, that the circumstances are different for everyone, but just seeing it there, you know, it's like, you know,
it can be done.
Yeah, it's, I mean, I wish I would have, you know, seen that before, you know, to even think that it was possible.
Yeah. Yeah. And speaking of, you have been super busy as of late, speaking at panels, hosting Q&A sessions. The most recent you just did was with Gustavo Arellano for the LA Public Library. You've been doing, I think you were pretty involved with the Hola Mexico Film Festival.
So that's another thing. What I do for them is there's a program for emerging Latino filmmakers that I coordinate. So that's one of something that I'm very proud of. I've been doing it now for maybe 4 years now, and I was part of the first one. So the first year I was one of the people that were partaking in that, and then they hired me to come coordinate it. And that's, you know, we choose, Diana Luna is the other person that she's the director of the program, and I'm the coordinator, and we choose 20 Latino filmmakers. And using that very sort of broadly in terms of, like, a lot of them are, like, you know, people from Latin America that live in the U.S., you know, some of them are, like, U.S.-born, U.S.-raised-based, mm-hmm. you know, Latinos, which is the ones that I think that are, those usually I think to be my focus in terms of, like, you know, because not to sort of, like, undermine the effort of the other ones, but I do feel like when you are from Latin America and you're able to come to the U.S. to study in a very famous school, you have privilege, right?
Yeah, like, there's still privilege.
Definitely not coming from a working class family, you know. Most likely, you know, if your family is able to send you to USC from, you know, being an international student, then that's different than sort of being working class, born in the U.S. and then raised, you know. So to me, there's the nuance there that you have to, you know, understand and be aware that, you know, a wheel ticket from Mexico City, even though he's coming from Mexico, he's in a better position than a kid from East LA or Carajay or Bell who's working class, you know, even though that person's born in the U.S., you know.
Yeah.
Not because you come from Latin America doesn't mean that you're, you know, less privileged than people here, you know, because there's wealthy people in Latin America. Anyway, so the group is like people from Latin America that are based in L.A., U.S.-born, U.S.-raised kids here, filmmakers in L.A., and so like we bring them together, and you know they're from different nationalities. We have, like, this year there was like a couple of Brazilians and Guatemalans and Nicaraguan Americans, a lot of them Mexicans, of course. And then there's a 20 cohort. All of them have a short film that we play at the festival in front of the feature films to sort of like give them a premiere of their short film in a big theater, big screen. And then during the week we have sessions with like different executives of filmmakers that we bring. So this year we had like Carlos Lopez Estrada, who's the director of Blindspotting and Summertime and Raya and the Last Dragon. We had Andres Manuel Soto, who directed Charm City Kings and who's directing the Blue Beetle movie.
Yeah, what's up?
Right.
Charm City Kings was really good.
Yeah, so he came to talk to them. So we have people from Netflix, people from Sundance, people from Ojalá, which is like a new initiative that Tania Saracho started. So we have all these people come meeting them and sort of like HBO.
Yeah, network, you build relationships.
Right, for these filmmakers to sort of have, you know, access to it. It's basically building a bridge, right? Because when you're a filmmaker, then you're just working on your stuff and you have no context in the industry. How do you even access these people?
Mm-hmm.
How do these people even become aware of who you are? You know, so the point is, like, we curated this group of people. We have the context for the studios and the executives, and we bring them together so they can meet and they see the films and they get to know this talent, and hopefully something will come from that.
Yeah,
you know?
Pick up their YouTube show, you know. Yeah, there's a lot of successful stories there, like Broad City, Insecure, right? They started out as, like, indie projects and got picked up.
So, yeah, so that's what that program is. And, you know, I also program some of the movies at the festival itself, the feature films from Mexico, which is something I really enjoy. I watch a lot of Mexican movies. So that's another sort of part of my year that focuses on something different.
That's a lot of work.
Yeah.
Putting on any event is a lot of work in itself. And then a film festival is like...
Right.
Because the last time I went to the Hola Festival was... they were having a screening of the El Santos documentary, and he was here in L.A., and I was like, oh, man, there's El Santo. I was like, shit. Yeah, I try to go every year and see, like, what's playing. Even though, like, this year there was, like, a mix of, like, online, in-person kind of stuff going on. But the last thing I wanted to talk to you about was this was something recent. You became a member of the National Society of Film Critics. And the way you talked about it on Twitter, and you were describing it, it's another monumental moment for you, and it's very impactful. So for us that, you know, aren't in the loop, who aren't familiar with the association, like give us like an explainer.
Right. So it's there are different organizations in every city that are critics organizations, right? So I'm part of LAFCA.
Yeah, LAFCA is LA Film Critics Association. A lot of acronyms to keep track of.
Right, so I'm part of that, right? And that's also that was a very big moment for me because that's sort of like the, I don't want to say the best, but like sort of the high profile critics in the city, you know, are part of that organization, and you know, it's your peers with your work, and they put you in, you know, it's a process that you apply, and then the groups read your work and decides whether you qualify to be a member or they want you to be a member, you know. So it was very significant just for my peers and in LA doing my work. So there's another organization in New York and Chicago, and most cities have their own critics organization, right?
Like the regional one.
Right. Yeah. So then the National Society of Film Critics is like the, you know, I don't want to say the best of the best, because best is always, but like, sort of like
it sounds like it's a national one.
Right. It's a combination of members from all of them. So like the ones that have been chosen from, so there's people from New York, from Chicago, from LA to form this group. And it's sort of like, it's like a, you know, it's been around for a long time. And it's sort of just like a very prominent organization that, you know, chooses awards and has like presence at festivals and things like that. And it's sort of like,
dang,
it means that, you know, to me, what that meant is sort of like they, you know, these are critics from all over the country that I respect. A lot of them have been around for a long time, that write for really important publications, you know, and that this group sort of like collectively voted to, you know, to let me in and be part of it just was very significant, just, you know, for me. And like, I don't know how many Latinos or, you know, any would have been in the part of this organization in its history. So it was just very significant to me that it was just not only being part of the LA community, but being accepted into this national organization for critics that, you know, that I didn't know if I was, you know, going to be accepted or not, especially on my first try. So yes, it was a great moment for sure.
Yeah, awesome. And congratulations, you know, well-deserved to be part and be acknowledged of like these spaces that are very in the trenches, very in the know for folks that are in that industry, but still play a big behind-the-scenes role in a lot of the stuff that happens behind the scenes, right? Of like who gets to go where, what's going on, and even, you know, adding to you and your reputation of as a critic, you know, continuing to write and freelance with so many different publications. Do you think? Or I mean, I'll just ask. Like, where do you see yourself going, like in the near future with your career? Like continuing to freelance? Do you think you might want to like maybe get like a columnist role or something more stable like that? Where do you think you're going?
You know, I don't know. I enjoy about, you know, being a freelancer is that freedom of, you know, being able to pitch and for the most part, write about things that I want to write.
Yeah.
Right. For the most part, you know, of course there are things that I get assigned in terms of like reviews, you know, that those are assigned to me and I, you know, just whether I had interest or no, you know, which is also an interesting exercise to like write about things that you didn't know that were out there and just sort of like engage with content that wasn't sort of like in your purview. But I enjoy sort of like pitching the things that I want to write about. And, you know, sometimes if it doesn't work out with a publication, I have the freedom of like going with someone else and see if they're interested, you know?
Yeah.
So I enjoy that. And I feel like that gives me sort of like the broadest sort of like, spectrum to have a presence, you know, to sort of like be, you know, put my work out there. So I really like that. I feel like a stable or like a staff position, which, you know, in the first place, there are very few. It's hard to get anything.
Yeah,
you know,
as you explained in that Vox piece.
Right. There are very few positions. So to be a film critic full time or to be a film writer full time. But if it was something where I could have that freedom of pursuing the things that I care about, whether it's about Latino film or international animation, and you know, if that position, you know, was allowed me to sort of like keep that freedom, then I would happily take it, you know. At this point, when I'm still relatively young and I feel like I could keep on going for a few more years, you know. I've always sort of like, for the past few years, a lot of people have told me that I should write a book. I don't know if I want to write a book.
I would say the same, but I know that it being casual about, like, you should write a book is not the same as writing a book.
Right. Right. So, and I know that. Because I'm like, the investment of time.
Yeah.
You know, and you know, and there's, you know, back in the back of my mind, you know, very sort of like fainting. It's that sort of, you know, thought of like, maybe one day I'll actually try to make a film, you know. Maybe I'll go back to that initial sort of like, you know, impetus that I had of like, you know, wanting to write something, you know, and missing happen and see, you know, just see for myself if it's even something that I'm good at, you know, because it's always, it could be hypothetical. It could be really good about watching movies or writing about movies, but not so much about making them, right? It's a different skill. So I don't know. I feel like it could be any of those things, you know, like writing something, whether it's not a personal, like, because that's another thing. Writing a book could be, you know, finding a subject that I want to write something more academic on, mm-hmm. or like straight up, like, you know, spilling my guts about my life, you know, which is like, who wants to read that? You know, but so it's one of those things, you know, like, so I consider those things, but then again, it's hard when you're in the daily grind, right? When like, when you're like in the grind of like, I need to make rent and I need to make money, I need to pitch another piece and I need to, and you know, when it comes to the film industry, you have to keep track of like release dates, right? So like, because this movie will be out of interest if you don't pitch it by this time,
that's
if it doesn't
very short
this
window
time,
yeah,
you know. So always being in that grind sort of like prevents you a little bit from thinking into these bigger sort of projects that will entail for you to like take time off or like take a block of time to like focus your attention mm-hmm. into this thing. Mm-hmm. So it's one of those things of like, maybe in the future, I don't know if right at this moment, you know, because I still feel like I'm still sort of like trying to push and like grind and see, you know, how far I can go.
Yeah, it sounds like you feel you still have more growing to do.
Right. And I think that's, I mean, I hope that a lot of people feel that way about themselves, because I feel like, you know, you, especially, and I don't think we talked about this, you know, like the fact that I don't have the degrees, it's something that, and I know you mentioned that like, oh, it doesn't matter. But to me, it's also like one of those things that like, the imposter syndrome comes around sometimes, you know, the idea of like, I've gotten all this and I have an AA from Pasadena City College.
Hey, at this point, I'm like, hell yeah.
I wish it could be more like that. But I have to admit that sometimes I still get into my head and I'm just like, is it?
I understand.
You know, like, are you even good enough for this? Like, are you, you know, like, it's even with like the accolades or the, you know, getting into these places and things like that, like this. Always in the back of my mind is, you know, sort of like inferiority complex of like, am I, you know,
it's real.
Am I, you know, am I just, you know, an imposter here trying to pass for this? And like, can I even write a book? You know, is that like a stupid idea, you know? So all those things that always come into play with like, you know, do I need to get better? I need to get better before I do this. I need to get better before I do that. And so
in your own time. Yeah, right. You'll come into it in your own time. I would say for me, age definitely helped a lot. And for me, it's just being in the community I was in. I'm very lucky and fortunate to be in the spaces I've been throughout my life. Very, you know, same as you, very supporting people, you know, helping you keep moving forward and helping you support in various ways so you can keep moving forward in your aspects of work and your career. So definitely fortunate in that. And that's where, for me, a lot of that confidence came in, you know, where you talk to folks, you vent with each other. You play each other's therapist, and it's just something to me that happened gradually over time. They're like, that confidence really starting to set in, and I'm like, now I'm like totally, you know, over the top. Like, I'm in places like USC or whatever, speaking to classes, and it's like, hell yeah, I spent 7 years at ELAC, and here I am in front of y'all. You know, y'all are paying $40,000 a year for your tuition, and you're listening to me because I have the expertise, right? So, and hopefully in time, you'll come to your own place of, like, comfort with that, too.
Yeah, I think, you know, it's, and it has to do with what we value as a society, right? Like, the paper of all papers, you know, mm-hmm. the paper of, like, you know, this idea of like illegality when you don't have the documents, or the idea that you're not a professional if you don't have the degree, you know, that
or you dress like it.
Right, exactly. So we value these sort of like, you know, conventions of success or of legitimacy, you know, that, you know, what do people call it? So, and I feel like that's, you know, everyone struggles with that in different ways, you know, and sometimes being in these spaces where people that are not even aware of any of these things. You know, like, I just had like a thing on Twitter yesterday about some, you know, that I was talking about how living in Sella, you know, in those communities, there's no art house theaters there. Like, if anyone wants to go to an art house theaters, you have to cross the city, you know? And this come this guy, you know, tweeting about, like, how, well, all these people could find affordable places in Hollywood and Encino and Highland Park. And I'm just like, you don't even know this. Like, your view so limited of the city, you know, he was probably a transplant to, you know, of the city, and that you don't even understand the communities that I'm talking about, because mm-hmm. you've never even seen mm-hmm. them. You don't even know they exist, you know? And to me, like, the fact that there's still so much ignorance or obliviousness about, you know, what those spaces are and, you know, what does that mean, is it's kind of shocking and sort of, like, annoying and frustrating, you know, that that even at that basic level of, like, people understanding where people come from and what I'm talking about, when I'm talking about, like, real working class people, not people that can afford to live in Encino, it's, you know, it's like that for most people that are part of the community, like, that's obvious, but, you know, clearly it's not obvious for everyone. And so when you're around people that don't even understand the basics of that, it's yeah. hard.
That's the internet. No end to the ignorance. I did want to ask you this randomly. Have you been to that movie theater in Southgate? The big, like, Cinépolis. I don't think it's Cinépolis, but, like, the big megaplex.
The Edwards?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, that was my go-to back then.
Yeah? What, so...
Besides Pacific, that was the one.
I went there a couple of years ago for... I don't know why. I forget even what I was. Oh, I know why. I had MoviePass. Mm. And I was like, hell yeah, let's fucking go anywhere. Like, go do this, all this other stuff. And we just happened to be in Southgate eating. And it's like, oh, cool. Like, let's go watch this movie, make a little thing out of it. And I went to the theater... And my jaw just dropped to the floor. Because I remember walking in. I remember seeing all the, like, the Mayan Aztec motif of, like, the building built into the architecture. Right. I was like, what the hell is this? And then we get inside. And I'm taken by surprise by how fucking huge it is, honestly. It's impressive. And the mural that's there.
With all the stars?
If you've never seen it, it's basically... a pyramid, like Aztec Mayan design pyramid, and you have a crowd of people walking up to it, but they're all celebrities. And I was like, oh, there's like so-and-so Will Smith. And
celebrities,
like,
from like the 90s, early 2000s. So it's like Angelina Jolie, Brad Pitt.
Yeah. I was like, what the hell? It's so kitsch, but it's so good at the same time.
Yeah, that was my go-to in high school too, whenever that theater in Pacific could close, that, like, we would go to Southgate, to the Edward Cinema. Yeah. And I remember occasionally, very rarely, they would play something a little out there. Like, I remember being shocked when they played Babel, the Iñárritu film from 2006.
Oh, that's right. That, but it's probably because it had Brad Pitt.
Right. Or because it had Gael too, you know. So maybe that's why. But, like, even something like that felt to me like super art house and fancy for a movie theater that only plays like the most mainstream, you know, things, you know. So yeah,
it's like the latest Minions movie.
Right.
So, no, I mean, everybody has their picks, right?
Right. Because he has like 20 screens too. So
yeah, it's huge.
Yeah, it's been around for a while.
Yeah, you can go watch the movies, go to Hooters, go to Planet Fitness, buy some Skechers.
They used to be now I'm like dating myself horribly, but like there used to be a Ritmo Latino.
Yeah. You go listen, like, to some music.
Yeah, like in Pacific Boulevard, there was a Ritmo Latino too, where you go buy your tickets to see Maná or something like that.
So, wrapping up, is there anything you got coming up? Any projects, speaking engagements that you want to, like, put folks on?
I mean, I'm always on Twitter sharing stuff. I don't have anything super soon coming up that's, like, relevant. And I might have a couple pieces in December that I'm excited about. I'm going to a few film festivals. I'm going to Virginia and Key West for some film festivals. And
yeah,
just always, you know, sort of posting on Twitter reviews and articles and things that I'm doing. So, yeah.
For sure. So you can follow Carlos at, and this is Twitter, @Carlos_films, right? Yeah. So you can keep, oh, film, sorry. I wrote it down too, but I'm on the wrong page looking at my questions.
It's Carlos_film.
Carlos_film. Keep up with what they're doing, their latest reviews. And yeah, thanks again so much for taking the time to come down to Bull Heights, to be here, to do this interview, and really just sharing with folks, you know, your amazing journey of, like, being, you know, a starstruck kid in Mexico watching movies to now, you know, being part of all these associations and building your name and reputation as a film critic.
Thank you for having me. It's been lovely and interesting to sort of go down memory lane with all these things.
Yeah, so this has been Audible Heights, and we'll catch you all in the next one.